So, folks, today there are more independent voters than either Democrats or Republicans. Bet you didn't know that. Or maybe you did because you're one of those independent voters. And in 2024, this year, 24 million of you, 24 million independent voters will be locked out of closed primaries for president or Congress, or even their state legislature. Across the country, you don't get to vote. You don't have a say in who the nominee of your party, or excuse me, the Democratic or Republican Party, should be. So, my guest today, Nick Troiano, is a reformer in this space. He is the author of The Primary Solution: Rescuing Our Democracy from the Fringes. He's the founding executive, a director of Unite America, which I serve as an advisor on that board. In 2014, Nick ran for the U.S. House of Representatives in Pennsylvania's 10th District and was both the youngest candidate of that cycle and the most competitive independent congressional candidate nationally in over two decades. But the process didn't allow him to win, didn't allow him to take advantage of the opportunities that are often afforded Democrats and Republicans in an electoral process. So we get into why reform and change is necessary. And I want you to be a part of that. Take some notes. Join me in my conversation with Nick Troiano right here on the Michael Steele podcast, coming up right after this. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. It's always a treat when you drop in and share some time. I'm, getting ready for the election season like all of us. And, you got to drill down and understand exactly what the hell you're doing and why you're doing it. And that's an important part of this process that we've already started with our presidential race, and a lot of state and local races are getting formed. And it's an important time for us to understand what we need to do as citizens, what our responsibility is, and is given to us by the Constitution, by the founders. You guys heard me talk about we the people. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. And this gentleman that I'm very happy to welcome to the podcast today, Nick Troiano, is one of these guys on the front line. Just for disclosure, I serve on an advisory board that he was a founding executive director for, Unite America, which again is in the spotlight of the democracy fight that we find ourselves in. So, Nick, it is great to have you here as part of the conversation. We're going to talk about your new book, The Primary Solution: Rescuing Our Democracy from the Fringes, which I am all about.
Oh,
So
great to be back with
know
you,
that.
Michael.
Yeah, man, it's good to see you. So this work on the primary solution focuses on something that has been very, very important to me over the years, and I know very, very well, and actually would argue, Nick, is the heart of the problems that we have right now in our electoral system, and that is our primary system. Give us a little bit of, if you can, some of the history of our primary system, its development, because a lot of people think, oh, it's been here forever. Well, no, not really. I mean,
Right.
it is relatively speaking, a fairly new creature in our politics, about 100 years old or less. And over the years has played, I think, an outsized role from its original intent, which was, okay, let's create a space for everybody to kind of come in and we can narrow it down and get the party bosses out of it. Give me the party bosses.
Right.
What say you, Nick?
Well, let me just begin by saying that, the reason why I wrote this book and also do this work every day with Unite America is because I've come to the conclusion and conviction that the biggest solvable problem in our politics right now is this party primary system, and it's been hiding in plain sight. And while most Americans who are frustrated with politics, will point to individual politicians, my encouragement with this book is that we need to go deeper to look at how do they get in office and what are the incentives they have that inform the way that they behave. And that goes back to this primary problem. To your question, we didn't always have party primaries in the country. You know, when the founders crafted our constitution, our system of government, they didn't prescribe party primaries because they feared the rise of political parties to begin with, right? So once you had parties develop, then they had to start thinking about, well, what's the process by which we nominate someone to be our standard bearer in the general election? And that process in the early days of the Republic was the caucus and convention system, which people may be more familiar by the old saying, the smoke-filled rooms, right? This is when you had the party bosses that you reference kind of handpick the candidates. And that led to all kinds of corruption because they would exchange favors essentially for who the candidate was that they'd chosen. And once that candidate is in office, what they did to reward the party and people who work for the party with sort of government jobs and so forth.
But they still do that, don't they? Even at this current system.
Right. Well, I think to your point is that a lot of the problems that they tried to solve by moving from this party boss system to direct primaries and giving voters the right to participate haven't exactly gone as the way that they intended, meaning that the idea of this reform was that it would democratize our elections, it would stamp out corruption, it would lead to less fracturous parties. But here we are over 100 years later, and we're still dealing with these problems. And that's essentially because, as I write in the book, that the party bases have now become the party bosses, and the system has been hijacked by activists and interest groups that have weaponized the primary process to push narrow agendas over the public interest. And that's the reason why I think this primary system is overdue for reform today.
So does your reform include blowing the whole damn thing up and starting over? Or is it, oh, let's just tinker at the edges and just kind of see what we can get away with?
The clarion call in the book is to abolish party primaries, and so
Yay.
I would categorize that under let's reimagine what this system can look like. And by that I mean let's disentangle the process by which the parties as private organizations should be able to recruit, endorse and support candidates. That's great. But the publicly funded government-run system of elections should serve the voters. And by that, we should have a primary system where the only purpose of a primary, even if we have one, should be to winnow a large field of candidates down to just a handful to the general election, not to serve as a nominating contest for either political party.
So when you note what you just did, that, look, we need to start with abolishing this current primary system the way it is. And you note in the book, the single most important thing we can do to improve representation in our government and hold it accountable to delivering better results is abolishing partisan primaries. What kind of arguments do you get in response to that? What is the sort of knee-jerk reaction to your proposal?
Well, I think from the parties themselves is, hey, don't mess around with our own process by which we get to choose our leader for the November election. And to that, I say, fine, but that process, as I mentioned before, should be separate from the process that all voters are paying for and that's administered by the government. And so I think that's the most common objection. I think other objections are raised, but not really in a good faith way. Of saying, oh, this new system that is being proposed might be too complicated, for example, or confusing. But let me tell you, the five states that have abolished party primaries, those voters like it. They don't want to go back.
Who,
We
which, which states are those?
so those states include Nebraska, Louisiana, Washington, California, and most recently Alaska. And they've all done this in a slightly different way, but the common denominator is that there is not a party primary that a candidate for public office has to run through first in order to get to the general election.
What are some of the examples of what they do that are notable? I'm familiar with two of them, Alaska and California. New York, Alaska having a ranked choice voting system, California having everybody in the pool, which then whittles itself down. But what are the the landscape look like in terms of what these states are doing?
Yes. So for either state or federal office, because it depends on the state,
Right.
in all but Louisiana, which actually got rid of the primaries, what the other four states did was replace the party primaries with what I call a nonpartisan primary. And so instead of having a Republican ballot and a Democratic ballot, you have an all candidate ballot. So everyone is listed with their party labels and all voters can participate. And as a voter, you can choose any candidate you want for any
So this is
office.
good for independent voters who typically are ostracized, locked out of a primary process because they don't identify with either party.
Exactly. There are 24 million independents this year, for example, that will not be able to participate in a party primary for president or Congress. And that's just wrong when you think about the fact that these elections are oftentimes the only elections that really matter because the
Right.
general election is locked in many districts. So what the four states have done with that all candidate primary is then open it up to everyone. And in California, Washington, Nebraska, it advances the top two finishers to the general election. In Alaska, they went one step further and advanced the top four finishers to the general election. And because you have four and you want someone to win with a majority support, not say 35% support,
Right.
they have an instant runoff. And that's why they use a ranked choice ballot to facilitate that. And that's the model that we think can be most powerful as other states consider adopting primary reform.
Independent voters aside, and largely not because they're not relevant, because I think they are. In fact, when I was state party chairman, I opened up our primaries in Maryland to our independent voters. Much to the chagrin of the party faithful, but I thought it was a worthwhile opportunity to do. And of course, immediately after I left the chairmanship, they reverted back to the traditional system. But what kind of people tend to show up and vote in primaries to begin with? How, you know, my experience at the county, state, and national levels is A, you're getting a very hardened base of supporters who turn out. B, that number tends to be really small relative to the registered voting population of either party. What are you finding out there?
I sort of compare it to a tailgate before the sports game, right? You have your most dedicated fans show up
Right.
with kind of their face paint on, and that's what the primary electorate looks like, your most committed partisans who tend to be the more ideological voters, and it's very low turnout. So the problem isn't that of who's participating in the sense of everyone should have a right to participate, it's who's not, and that the electorate
Right.
isn't very representative. And as a result of it being so low turnout, it opens the doors to all sorts of interest groups that can spend what is a relatively small amount of money to, advance their agenda and cause candidates to take all sorts of positions that aren't very sincerely held. And so it pushes the respective parties to the further right and further left. It's often why in competitive seats, the few that exist are states, you often hear about candidates who have to reinvent themselves after the primary, right? It's go tack left or tack right. And then for the general election, it's how do you reinvent yourself to
Right.
appeal to the swing voter? That's a
Right.
strange process we make candidates go through.
It is, and it says a lot about the inefficiency of the system, because you do leave a lot of votes on the floor that aren't counted. You because they don't get to participate, and then the ones who do come in, and because it's such a narrowly tailored group of folks who have a very strong ideological bent relative to everybody else in the party, it does skew the game a little bit. So it goes, like I said, I was familiar with the Alaska example. As you noted, they replaced their party primaries with the sort of nonpartisan effort in I think it was what 2020. Was the first time they went into this space. What has changed in their system, particularly given sort of the ranked choice voting aspect of it at the end, to sort of get to 50%? Because that then is going to set up another question I have for you. But I'd like to at least sort of look at an Alaskan example of how that process works and what the voter response is, what the turnout levels have been, et cetera.
Well, first, let me describe it from a voter perspective and then from a candidate perspective. So,
Sure.
from a voter perspective, what's changed is that every voter, regardless of their party, can vote for any candidate now, and their ballot is much more powerful because they can vote in elections in which their vote actually matters. We saw, while turnout was about the same before and after this reform was in place, we saw a 60% increase in the number of voters who cast ballots in competitive elections that weren't already determined by party affiliation. So it gives voters a lot more power to hold their elected leaders accountable. From a candidate perspective, what it does is incentivize candidates to build broad coalitions and majority support in order to win elections, because no longer does their route to office run just through their party base of, say, 5 to 10% of voters. They have to build a winning 51% plus coalition. And I think that's best represented in the story of a state senator there named Kathy Geisel. She's a Republican. She was primaried out of office in 2020 because she was one of the members who was working more collaboratively across the aisle. And when this system was adopted, she ran again for re-election and completely reinvented the way that she'd campaign. In the past, she would only knock on the doors of the Republican primary voters that would matter in the election. This time around, she said that she knocked on every door in her district because she was incentivized to build a majority coalition. And under the ranked choice voting system, she was able to tell Democrats who she met, well, if you don't rank me first, rank me second, because a Democrat's unlikely to win this district. So if you want your vote to still matter after you choose who you prefer, wouldn't you rather have me being someone who's more pragmatic than someone who's more extreme, like the incumbent was who defeated her? So that wound up not only working out well for the voters and for Senator Geisel in this case, but the last thing I'd mention is that when she returned to the state legislature, she helped form a bipartisan governing caucus. So Democrats and Republicans formed this coalition in the legislature that said, we're going to put the divisive issues aside and focus on where we can find common ground on the major challenges facing Alaska. And for the extremists that didn't want to be part of that, they're not in the caucus, and the bipartisan group is the one that is in control. That's what this reform really enabled to have happen there.
I love the Alaska example, and I really think people need to and it, which is the power of your book and the work that you guys are doing at Unite America, is to level up that conversation so people can really understand what reform looks like and how successful reform could be. I do a lot of work. I'm a strong supporter of ranked choice voting, but most especially a great deal of work in the national popular vote space, which members of the folks on this podcast know I've talked about. But just as a quick refresher, is a process which reforms the Electoral College process that allows the states to enter into a compact, in which they agree when they enter the compact that the winner of the national popular vote, person who gets the most popular vote, will win their state's electoral college vote, irrespective of party affiliation. And right now, they are, I believe, the number 65 electoral college votes away from implementing the national popular vote. And so the states have been slowly coming into this space. It is a slog. It is reforming the way election officials, less so, but certainly legislators who actually set the electoral game plan in every state to understand exactly what the reform is. And I suspect that's part of your challenge as well, is leveling up the conversation so that people understand exactly what this is, and more importantly, what it isn't, because it's easier to throw crap on the wall and say that it's art, but it still stinks and it still looks like shit. So I mean, I don't know what else I can say to that. So it's important that people understand exactly what it is and what it isn't. There are 45 other states out there that do not have this type of reform in place. How easy or daunting a challenge is that in light of the what you lay out in your book, which we'll get into a little bit more in a second, because there are some specific steps that you reference that I think is be important to know. But it, just broadly speaking, you got five states that have sort of taken a more advanced look at their process and go, you know what, this sucks, let's fix it. And then you've got 45 other states to kind of go, hey, man, we kind of like the chaos.
Well, I think first to your prior point on national popular vote, what a lot of these reforms share in common is about we should have government of, by, and for a majority
Exactly.
of the people. That's an enduring principle of what our democratic republic ought to be about. We don't have that today. When 83% of congressional seats are decided in primaries, and when only 8% of eligible voters participate in them, we have a small fraction of people deciding who most of our leaders are. And so, if you're one of those voters who scratch your head and wonder why isn't Congress representing us when we the people can find agreement on this issue or that, it's because Congress literally doesn't represent a majority of us. And that's what
Right.
these election reforms are out to change. The good news is that, to the point before, the current system isn't prescribed in the Constitution, which means that it doesn't require an amendment or it doesn't even require an act of Congress in order for these reforms to be enacted. So for the 45 other states that don't have a nonpartisan primary, the path to enacting one is either through the state legislatures, or in half the states, they have a direct citizen initiative process, which
Right.
was another progressive era reform
Right.
that was created a little over a century ago. And that's how several of the existing states that have primary reform adopted it, is by going directly to the voters. That's what Alaska did in 2020. Nevada did this in 2022 in a state where it actually has to pass twice in a row. So it's actually back on the ballot this year. And there's a half dozen other states that are currently collecting signatures to qualify an initiative to ask voters this November, would you like to have a system in which your vote matters, including in states where there are hundreds of thousands or millions of independents who are currently locked out. So I think this is a not only important effort, but a viable one because the people are hungry for this type of change and they themselves can directly decide it in many states.
They are very hungry for it, and like the hunger they have in other aspects of our body politic in terms of policy or specific policy issues, from the Second Amendment and guns to abortion, et cetera. There is a general consensus around a lot more issues than people are often led to believe. And what is important and somewhat ironic is that there's also a general consensus in this space. More people would like the ability of independent voters to participate in primaries. More people are less in love with primaries, generally speaking, and don't have a problem with them going away or at least being reformed. So it is from many perspectives, when you stop and look at it, it is the established order of things, the Democratic and Republican parties that have institutionalized the current system the way it is, that don't want these changes. So the legislative route, and certainly the citizen initiative route are the two options. And to the extent that citizens are able to put those initiatives on the ballot, as you noted, about half those states remaining have that capacity. Are there efforts to galvanize voters to put those initiatives, as we see happening with some other big policy issues right now? For example, state of Florida just approved putting abortion on the ballot because citizens wanted the initiative. The legislators tried to block it and stop it. They sued. They won. What are some of the efforts that are out there, at least setting the legislative side aside, because to the side for a moment, because that's just a bucket of crazy to deal with those folks. But for citizens to directly put these types of initiatives in play.
Well, I'll give you one example, which is in the state of Idaho. And right now, there are some 2,000 volunteers throughout the state that have collected over 70,000 signatures to qualify an initiative for this November's ballot that would model just the like the Alaska style
Mm-hmm.
policy. And so it's an incredible grassroots effort based on the premise that every taxpayer should have access to the elections. And it has support, this initiative, by the former three-term Republican governor, Butch Otter, the former Republican state Supreme Court Justice Jim Jones, and of course, tens of thousands of citizens who would like to see a better way. And this is in a state that, you know, it's not a competitive purple state. It's a
Right.
solid Republican state, but there is a civil war within the party there of the governing wing of the Republican Party, you know, versus an extremist wing that's not interested in governing. And that wing is on the ascendancy because the elections there empower small factions of voters to decide them, where the
Right.
Republican primary is the whole ball game, right, in that state. And so that's what citizens are looking to change. And that's one of the states that I think we'll be paying attention to, you know, this November. But to your prior point, I would say, and also ask you as a former party chair, is there's a reflexivity of opposition from the parties, but
Right.
how's the current system working out for them? Meaning, if you're the Republican Party in the last midterm
Yes.
elections, you know, you nominated five candidates for these contested competitive Senate races that all lost because the party nominee was far outside of the mainstream voter. And so if you're Mitch McConnell and you're talking about candidate quality, you're really talking about how is this primary system designed to produce the kind of candidate who's capable of winning?
Oh yeah, man, you're speaking music to my ears. It is one of the things I immediately had to dance with as national chairman. I've had to deal with it as a county chairman and state party chair. Candidate quality is essential to party success, but more importantly, it's essential to having good governance because it matters the people you put in front of the public. And it matters what those individuals will or will not do in office. And as I tell voters all the time, stop acting like you're a this is a disembodied process. These candidates are an exact extension of you. They are an exact extension of what you think, what you believe, what you want. And so to sit there and pretend that there's no, well, I didn't vote for him. Well, you didn't vote. So there's that. Okay, let's start this. Don't give me attitude about, well, I didn't vote for that person. Well, you didn't vote at all. Or you sat there and wrote a name in, which is fine. It's part of the process. You can write someone's name in, but we're in a binary system and you need to fundamentally understand that there's certain things that you do in a binary system that still count as a vote for the person you don't want to win, or the person you do want to win. And so the fundamentally un not understanding how our system works is important. But more important than that is knowing that these candidates that are on the ballot, a Marjorie Taylor Greene is an exact extension of the people who supported her in that district. And she now represents everybody in that district. And so you don't get to walk away from that and pretend, oh, well, there's nothing I can do because, fill in the blank. There are things that can be done. And I want to get into some of that with you. We're going to take a quick break. We're having a great conversation with the author of the new book, The Primary Solution. It is a great book that's out right now for folks. Nick Troiano, my mouth is falling apart on me. Unite America. We're going to take a, I need that break. So I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get into a little bit more of the book that Nick has got out there. It's a great primer, folks. You need to get a copy of it. We'll be right back with Nick right after this.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're sort of drilling down a little bit today on the other side of the electoral process, which is, you know, the process itself, and the tools and mechanisms that are at stake and put into play to run our nation's primary system, and the impact that it's having right now on outcomes from policy to the kinds of candidates. Nick Troiano is the author of The Primary Solution, Rescuing Our Democracy from the Fringes. So Nick, in the book, you really kind of break it down, and I thought it was a couple of things. First off, you talk about the Republican Party's primary problem, which you referenced a bit before we went to break, is arguably more severe at this point, though the Democrats may be catching up soon enough. Now, the Democrats just did a very interesting thing in their primary where they bypassed the traditional, oh, let's start with the whitest state in the country, Iowa, and then go to the most independent state in the country, New Hampshire, to sort of set the tone for our primaries, which states have very little relevance to the ultimate, to the cross section of states that are out there. It's not the best, in my view, representation of where I think you should begin. But talk to me a little bit about the Republican Party's primary problem and why the Democrats may be experiencing that same problem, even though they just made a reform that starts their primary in South Carolina, shakes it up a little bit.
Right. Well, when you look at Congress, for example, the first problem I referenced earlier was on the Republican side, the party primary system is nominating candidates who are not competitive and losing winnable general elections. And so that has narrowed the Republican majority, say in the House,
right,
to a very slim margin.
To one.
And then, yeah, right now it's one. And who has the power when the margin is that small, but the people who are willing to leverage their votes to do some crazy things. And
right,
those are people on the far right, like the Marjorie Taylor Greens, who were effectively elected with less than 10% of voters in their district and party primaries. And they're willing to throw grenades into the process. It's why we didn't have a House Speaker for a couple of weeks. It's why
right,
we're constantly at the cusp of a government shutdown. And so, again, if you're the political party that's interested in one, winning, and then two, governing so that you can advance your agenda, the party primary system is the biggest liability you're carrying that's inhibiting you to do those two things. And so that's the problem that I think the Republicans are facing today. And I say the Democrats aren't far behind them, because if you look at the last midterms, well, here's one example, Kurt Schrader, who served several terms in the U.S. House, known as a problem solver, a blue dog Democrat,
right,
which effectively now have been hunted to near extinction in party primaries. You know, he was running for re-election in Oregon. Not only was his district changed, but then he got primaried for his work on the bipartisan infrastructure bill by someone who more closely associated with the Democratic Socialists. She winds up beating him in a closed primary where independents couldn't vote, and then losing the general election to Republican. So if you're the Democratic Party,
right,
you know, you've lost someone who was one of the reasons why you were not able to win a majority in the House, right? So that's their version of this problem, and they're not far behind, because the Justice Democrats post Bernie Sanders' presidential run in 2016 have utilized this strategy to primary, you know, more pragmatic Democrats out of office if they weren't, you know, towing the party line.
Right, but given what we saw in the 2022 cycle, where there was this great prediction of the Republican red wave, and Democrats were going to get swamped by this red wave. Well, it wasn't even a good, you know, bathtub flow of water. What happened there? What was the translation? Was it the example that you've given us of just bad primary processes and outcomes setting up losing general elections? And connect that dot to
sure,
the 24 cycle, where you have a Democratic presidential nominee who, on his good day, is about 43% approval with voters. And does that then reimagine a red wave of sorts? Because in a presidential, the presidential candidate is the one that's more the driver than what you see in the individual races where people say, well, this candidate sucks. I can't vote for him. How does that work? What's the balance? What's the trade-off? What is how do those numbers change in a primary process for candidates who don't want to, doing the Heisman with Biden in their primary, or may even wind up doing the Heisman with Biden in the general, versus
Yeah, I would.
Republicans who are like, okay, we got Trump, and so
Right.
we're all in.
Yeah. Well, just to use a couple examples, in 22, you remember Herschel Walker in Georgia, or Dr.
Yes.
Oz
Yeah.
in Pennsylvania, or Kerry Lake, in Arizona. Like, these were not going to be candidates that were going to be successful in the general election. They represented the median voter in the Republican primary, but were far away from the median voter in the general election, which is why I think the red wave that would have maybe otherwise manifested was much m more muted. But taking a step back and looking at this cycle, like, what is the overriding dynamic of our politics right now? It is which party is less despised or
Right.
mistrusted or
Which one
hated by
sucks less than
President.
the
Yes, and I think voters are sick of
other?
having this sort of lesser of two evils binary
Right.
contest. And you're not wrong that politics right now is a binary, and that's what's wrong fundamentally with our politics, because when you have a heads up race of one team red and against team blue, they don't have to convince you of why they deserve your vote. They just have to convince you why the other one is going to be terrible, if not a threat to the country. And that's why we've become so divided and polarized, to the point where there's now movies about the next, civil war in the country that doesn't seem so much like fiction
Right,
because
right.
of how dangerous this moment has become. So when you think about the Alaska system, when you have general elections with four candidates, now that could be two Democrats and two Republicans, or toss in an independent or third party candidate, they can't just campaign on not being the other guy or the other gal. They have to campaign on the affirmative case for why voters should support them. And that's the real power that I think these reforms can have in reimagining the way our democracy can function and the way that people participate in it, and to give something for people to vote for and not just against.
Yeah, it's I think it's going to be a real interesting challenge to what we think we know about the primaries and certainly the general elections this cycle. I think you're right that those candidates that are winning in some primaries right now are not going to translate the way certainly the way some in the Republican Party think they will, and there are Republican. So sort of old political hands who kind of understand that, but have kind of given up trying to make the case because there's just no room for that discussion. So then that begs the question on the other side of yet another losing cycle where not only do you lose the presidency, but you then lose the House. And if you pick up the Senate, you don't get as many seats as you should have gotten, given where the numbers
Right.
tell you you should be. Or in my view, I think the Democrats hold on to the Senate because of some of the other issues that we talked about, actually driving voters in a general election, who, are using those issues up against those candidates who won those primaries but had to, tack to the hard right, for example, on abortion, which now in a general election, in a seat that you arguably should be won, that's now hanging over your head. So you have all of these various dynamics. You talk about in the book, I believe it's in ch near chapter six, you talk about abolishing partisan primaries having some benefits, and you list out five of them. I'd like you to give us a sense of the impact of these five. You talk about all voters. Voices being heard, elections being decided by a majority of voters, as you mentioned before, not as few as 8%. Elections producing less ideological extreme outcomes. Incumbents facing all voters without fear of being primaried. And the positive consequences, you argue, from presumably those first four are just going to compound. So if that's the case with these primaries, with eliminating the primaries, why haven't we done it? How do we get these benefits in the main, in the bloodstream so that people really see, oh yeah, this is what we need to do.
Right. Well, on the benefits, let me emphasize one about removing the threat of being primaried,
Primary.
because this is the reason I began this work over a decade ago. I was an advocate, a student at the time, around the issue of our country's growing national debt and our fiscal crisis, which is entirely predictable when you see the trends of a country that continues to spend trillions of dollars more than it's taking in. That is the definition of unsustainable. But why haven't we been able to tackle that issue, right? Around the time of 2010, there was a bipartisan fiscal commission that said, the solution's a matter of arithmetic. We have to raise some new revenue. We have to cut some spending. We have to reform our major social insurance programs. We've done none of those things because the threat of being primaried is the overriding incentive of both Republicans and
Yep, it
Democrats. If
is.
you're a
It is.
Republican, you cannot have your name associated with any revenue increase. If you're a Democrat, you don't want to be touching any of the Social Security, Medicare, et cetera, because that's a recipe for you getting primary out of office. And so the result of that has been 10 years since that bipartisan commission, where we've added another $10 trillion to our debt. Interest is now more than we're spending on national defense. Think about that.
Yeah.
And that's the same pattern that's playing out on every other issue that we care about, on climate, on our economy, on immigration, right? We're still facing this crisis at our border with our economy, the folks that are here in an undocumented way without a path to legal status. I mean, these problems continue to compound and fester because of the inability for our Congress to act, and the threat of being primary is such a big reason for that. With these reforms, you remove that threat and you liberate our leaders to actually govern in the public interest, to be able to put country over party and say, actually, a majority of my constituents would be in favor of doing this or that. And ultimately, that's the promise of election reform, is that we regain our capacity to solve the largest challenges, facing the country. It doesn't mean those things are going to happen overnight.
Right.
This isn't a silver bullet, but no longer will primaries be the gating factor for our inability to do that. And I think we'll be in a much healthier position once we get there. And by the way, the whole premise of this movement is that we don't have to win these reforms in every state in order to do that. But if we're able to, as I write about, win Alaska-style reform in six more states by 2026, that's a dozen more senators and a few dozen more members of Congress who can rebuild that pragmatic center in our Congress that we've seemed to lost have lost over the last decade.
Right. Now, I agree with that assessment, and but you do have elements out there that make it interesting and probably in the minds of some voters, but certainly in front in the minds of establishment thinkers, this idea of third parties. We are in a space where you're watching Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who I think at the end of the day won't even probably top out at Ross Perot numbers in from 1992, but it's clearly having a psychological impact, if nothing else, on the Democratic primary. And ultimately, now that he's running, I guess, as an independent, the Republic, the general election. So you have this sort of third party space, which I've always been an advocate for, not just two parties, but multiple parties, not just three, five or six. To sort of, I think, is a better reflection of a pluralistic society because that spectrum kind of runs that way. And maybe that's something that happens over time, but it's there. So ranked choice voting has a role that it can play in that sort of process for sure. How does it impact a third party play? But then on a different tip, what do you say about these reforms and their impact on communities of color? that black and brown communities will be yet again marginalized out of the process, disincentivized to participate.
Well, on that front, let's just use a real world example right now, which is in Louisiana. It's one of the states that in the 1970s actually got rid of their party primaries. They have a general election. Every candidate can run it. And if no one gets a majority, there's a runoff. The new governor, who was elected last year, coming into office this year, wanted to make a push to close the primaries there. And that's a bill that is currently being considered in the legislative session. If they are successful in closing the primaries.
But wait a minute. Did you say that they got rid of their primaries or what in the 70s?
Yeah, they did. There's no primary election there. There's a general.
So what is he trying to close?
So he's trying to re-implement a party primary.
Okay, he wants to re-implement a closed party primary.
Correct.
System. Okay, gotcha.
Yes, and if he's successful in doing that, the only elections that will matter in a red state like Louisiana is the Republican primary, right. Which means that if you're an independent or a Democrat, your vote won't matter.
But wait,
guess
what?
Can
I stop right there for a second? Well, didn't he get elected by the process that he's now
yes.
trying to change? So what's his beef?
That's a good question. So someone should ask him, because guess what? It's going to cost the state close to $100 million over the next decade if they were to do this, because they have to start paying to run more elections. No one's asking for this. There's not a problem that they're trying to solve, but it's become, as you're familiar, part of the base Republican ethos right now that closed elections are...
Because the bullshitters and the grifters can't play in that system. They won't win. That's the problem. So
right.
They want to create a system in which they know they can control the outcome, because very few people will participate. Because trust me, if they implement that system, rank and file voters who ordinarily would play are going, this is crazy. I'm not going to play. I don't want to, do that. And they'll basically go back to what we have in the other states. And that's the end game.
Right. And to your question, how does this impact communities of color? If independents and Democrats don't have a ballot that matters, that's 98% of black voters in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And so what the impact of the system is to take us back to where, unfortunately, many states in the South were, 50, 70 years ago, which is white primaries. They actually used the primary process to say only whites can participate. That
yeah.
was struck down by the Supreme Court on it. And that's where we will end up again if closed primaries becomes a policy. So I believe opening primaries is a pro-voter reform. It will enfranchise more voters, especially independents. And you can see the rates of young Hispanics, for example, disproportionately registering as independents. So this is good for all voters, I think communities of color in particular. And when you look at systems like ranked choice voting that's used in combination with a nonpartisan primary, it directly gets at the vote splitting challenge that often disadvantages women and candidates of color who are running for office and split the votes with similar candidates and wind up don't getting elected. So I think this will level the playing field, not just for candidates of different demographics, but also different political ideologies that right now are disadvantaged by a very closed system.
So the one of the big takeaways from your book really affirms for me a sort of, it's not a scientific poll, but I do it at every speech that I give across the country in the audience. I've done it. I've asked this question in audiences as small as 15 or 20 and as large as 1,000 people. And the question is, how many in this room believe that both the Democratic and Republican parties want every voter who's eligible and legally capable of voting to vote? And Nick, it has yet. I did have this, the last time I asked this question, which was about 2 weeks ago, one guy in a room of 700 people raised his hand, one person. But up to that point, not one hand in the room would go up. And the fact that only one went up in a room of 700 people, right? The point is, the American people don't believe this system wants them to participate. as it is currently constituted. The American people feel this system is designed to disenfranchise them from participation, which is why what you write and the work you're doing at Unite America is important to give the power back to people, and to upend the effort by state legislators to get in the way of putting good public policy in place that will, when that question is asked, people know that that's no longer the paradigm. There's a new paradigm now. We're not looking to the parties, the Republican or Democratic parties, to allow us to vote. We control this outcome now. We control this process. And I think that is the better solution in the end.
Well, I've been in those rooms, a couple of those rooms where you've asked that question, and I think it is very telling because people can see through it. I think people understand that both parties are perfectly content being a slim majority of a declining market share of voters because all
Well
they care
put.
about is
Well put.
power. They don't care about participation. And so when we're fighting Democrats in Nevada who are opposed to enfranchising 600,000 independents in that state, or fighting Republicans in Alaska who want to take the state back to the time when independents couldn't participate, we're onto something when both parties are opposed to it. And I think the voters see through it. That doesn't mean, though, that every Democrat or Republican elected official is against these reforms. One of the best parts about this work is getting to work with people like the Speaker of the Oregon State House, Dan Rayfield, who is the champion of a ranked choice voting bill that will now be referred to the voters this November, or in Maine, a bipartisan group of legislators who passed an open primaries bill that was used for the first time this year. So I think there are good D's and R's in office who are with us on this, and it's incumbent on us to give them the support and cover they need to be able to take their parties on in pushing these ideas.
Well, I encourage you to continue the work, my friend. I am proud to stand alongside you in that effort. I have watched you over the years from when we first met to now, just sort of really bring smart, intelligent conversation, and that's backed up by not just effort but success. And so it really is a turning point opportunity that I think is going to be made more important in this presidential cycle for how we go forward. I think a lot of things are going to be they were starting to be revealed in the 2020 election. I think they'll be even more revealed in this one, which sets up very much an opportunity for the kinds of reforms that you advocate in your book, The Primary Solution: Rescuing Our Democracy from the Fringes. Nick Troiano, thank you so much for being on the podcast, man.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Just keep the work, baby. Just keep it going. Just keep that light shining. Like I tell people, I'm a Motel 6 Republican because someone's got to keep the lights on. You've got your own Motel 6 going on in terms of, keeping the vote alive for voters out there and letting them see that there's some real light that they can move into in the
Thank
kinds
you.
of reforms that you're advocating. So I'm just really, really happy you could spend some time with us. Folks, thanks. Thanks again to Nick and all of you for being a part of the conversation. Check out Nick's work at Unite America. What's the give me the website again? It's
It's
United
uniteamerica.org.
.org. I was thinking .com, .org. UniteAmerica.org, and follow Nick on X, Twitter, whatever Elon's calling it these days, at Nick Troiano. But do the download thing because you just make me feel all yummy inside. So until next time, folks, be well, take care, God bless. And hey, primary season's upon us. Get out there and
Vote.
vote. Get out there and vote. Don't let these bastards put these numbnuts up. You know who you want. Go out and get them. Take care, folks.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.